Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in our second half hour, looking forward to this, retired Iowa Judge Douglas Russell. He's the author of a couple of books about Winston Churchill. So we'll be discussing Winston Churchill in light of the Oscar-nominated film Darkest Hour, a film that covers the early days of the Second World War when the fate of Western Europe hung on this newly appointed British Prime Minister. But first, my guest this half hour is Paul Connors. He's Canada's Consul General for Iowa. Connors specializes in economic policy with a focus on natural resources. He's been posted to Switzerland, Germany, Mexico, twice to Washington, D.C. He served in the Nuclear Policy Division. In 2016, Connors was appointed as consul to Minneapolis to lead foreign policy and public affairs, covering these aspects of Canada's relations with five states, Minnesota, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and, of course, Iowa. Paul Connors joins us for this first half hour. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for being on with us. Many would not know of your existence, your position's existence, I should say, as well. So let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about your position as Consul General. What do you do, and how is the work that you do perhaps different than an ambassador?
Sure. So a Consulate General is, describe it as a wholly owned subsidiary of an embassy. In most countries in the world, Canada and the United States, we have an embassy in a foreign capital, and that's it, and we cover our bilateral relationships there. But sometimes countries feel that the size and breadth of the relationship is so large that you need some sub-offices, and that's the case with both Canada and the United States. So the United States, in addition to its embassy in Ottawa, they have consulates in Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg, Toronto, Montreal, Quebec City, Halifax. And Canada, in addition to our embassy in Washington, we have 12 consulates in the major cities throughout the United States, and, of course, we have one in Minneapolis covering the five states that you enumerated.
Mm-hmm. And your focus is on citizens of Canada that happen to be in these five states, including Iowa, but also on trade. Any other focuses?
Yeah, there's sort of you've hit the highlights. One thing that an embassy or a consulate always does is what's called consular affairs, which is looking after their citizens abroad when they get in trouble. And the vast majority of that time, that's an American in Canada who loses his passport or a Canadian in the United States that loses his passport and they need to get some documents done to get home. That's the consular function. And the other two large functions, one is developing and deepening the great business relationship that exists between our countries, and the other is working on the public policy piece. So our American friends in Canada chat with provincial governments and the national governments as we're developing new policies on ways and suggestions to best do those policies to our mutual interests. And that's what we do in the consulate with our five states, including Iowa, to try to deepen that relationship and come out with the best public policy results. And the last thing that your listeners might find of interest, Ben, is we also try to promote Canadian culture in the United States. That's not sort of the commercial stuff, the big groups and movie stars that do well on their own, but sort of at the less commercial level. And if you'll allow me to do a plug with your listeners, in later this month in March, we're going to be doing featuring some Canadian films at the Dubuque Film Festival, and I'm going to be going down to that. And also in March, Omaha is having their film festival, and they're going to feature Canada for the first time. So I'm hoping some of your listeners in Council Bluffs will cross the river and go check out the Omaha Film Festival this year.
Okay, Paul Connors, Canada's Consul General for Iowa and four other states. If you've got a question for Paul, join us this first half hour by dialing 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about what's been in the news very often, especially since the election of the U.S., current U.S. president, NAFTA. Now, your Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, visited the U.S. Last month, I believe, and this was sort of a key to what he was discussing. In fact, I think he quoted our president, Ronald Reagan, some 30 years ago in talking about NAFTA. The quote he used, "If trade between Canada and the U.S. is a bad idea, then there are no good ideas." Compare that with the current president, President Trump, famously calling NAFTA the worst trade deal ever made. Before I have you comment here, Paul Connors, let me play a little bit of Donald Trump from the campaign trail talking about NAFTA, of course, a major part of his campaign.
"I'm going to tell our NAFTA partners that I intend to immediately renegotiate the terms of that agreement to get a better deal by a lot, not just a little, by a lot for our workers. And if they don't agree to a renegotiation, which they might not, because they're so used to having their own way, not with Trump, they won't have their own way, then I will submit under Article 2205 of the NAFTA agreement that America intends to withdraw from the deal."
Okay, Donald Trump back in 2016 on the campaign trail, harsh words about NAFTA. So, Paul Connors, now we find ourselves, I think, just a bit before the seventh round of negotiations. Bring us up to speed on what's happening with the North American Free Trade Agreement. Is it a renegotiation of it? What is it?
It is a renegotiation. Thank you for playing that clip. What I would underline from that clip, as you noted, that was language during the election campaign. What I would point out to you and your listeners, Ben, is a couple weeks ago, the president gave some remarks at the National Farm Bureau's meeting in Tennessee, where he stated the goal was to get a better deal and to get a great deal. So I think Canada and Mexico would associate themselves with that. We're all working to NAFTA's over 20 years old. It came into force in 1994. So the three countries have set out an ambitious agenda to go through the treaty chapter by chapter, update it, and get a better deal. So while we're pointing out political quotes, I would also point out to you and your listeners that in July at National Governors this past year in Rhode Island, Vice President Mike Pence stood up and gave a great speech where he said what the United States wants from the NAFTA renegotiation is a win-win-win to make it better for all three countries. So I think, you know, as we look to the administration, they have said, the president and members of his administration have said a lot of positive things. In addition to what you cited, they've said a lot of positive things about let's get NAFTA updated and make it better.
Right. So President Trump, then candidate Trump's position that it was tremendously lopsided in favor of you Canadians is not what we're seeing in actual negotiation, is what you're saying. There's a softening of it, or when it comes to we get off the campaign trail, off the soapbox, are we tinkering with it? How would you characterize the points that are being discussed for change?
Sure, Ben. Well, for some context, let me give you some numbers. So the largest export market by far for the United States is Canada. You sell more to Canada than you do to China, Japan, and the United Kingdom combined. We are your largest export market. And your second largest export market is Mexico. There are your NAFTA partners, and that underlines the rationale for why we have a free trade agreement with each other. If I just do Iowa's figures, almost half of your exports go to Canada and Mexico. So 30% of your exports go to Canada and 17% to Mexico. So almost half are going to those two NAFTA markets. And your largest sector economically is agriculture. And if I just do the ag sector, the orders reverse. 34% of all the ag exports that Iowa produces so wonderfully go to Mexico, and Canada is tied with Japan in second place at 17%. So that's a little over half of your agricultural exports going to your NAFTA partners. Since we brought NAFTA into force in 1994, trade between the three countries has tripled, but trade in the ag sector has quadrupled. So if we look at the numbers of NAFTA, it's clearly win-win-win and has been for the three countries. And we would concede that after 20-some years, going through the text and updating it makes imminent sense.
Mm-hmm. So there are downsides, I assume, for each country. This is what Donald Trump was speaking to, the people who have not benefited from NAFTA in this country, perhaps have lost a job in manufacturing because of NAFTA. Are there similar complaints in Canada among some people that NAFTA has not been a good deal for Canada?
No, I would say in Canada, we don't have the rhetoric to that degree. I think there's an appreciation in Canada. When you look at the statistics, there have been manufacturing job losses in Canada and the United States in the last couple decades. Most of the studies, when you look at them, will tell you that about three-quarters of manufacturing job losses have been because of technology improvements and productivity gains. Certainly, there's been a little bit because of trade. But generally speaking, that challenge in manufacturing is because we're getting quite more productive with our technology, which overall is a good thing for the economy. When if you want to specifically look at NAFTA only through the lens of manufacturing jobs, we kind of scratch our head on that one a little bit in Canada. Because if you look at just Canada-U.S. trade, 2016, it was $635 billion a day, and that's not loonies, that's U.S. dollars. And that's almost $2 billion a day in trade that our two countries do. And on that $635 billion worth of trade for the whole year, the United States, according to the United States Trade Representative, had a small surplus of $12.5 billion. So we have an enormous trading relationship, and it's in balance with you guys having a very tiny surplus with us. But if we break out the manufacturing sector only, you had an enormous surplus with Canada of $36 billion a year. You basically do a lot better in the manufactured goods sector on the trade between our two countries. And then what brings that trade back in balance is Canada has a significant surplus on primary energy. We had a $37 billion surplus on our primary energy trade in 2016, and that's mainly crude oil. So you are increasing your domestic production of oil in this country. You're an incredibly impressive producer of oil, but you still consume more than you produce, and Canada is your largest supplier. So if the concern is the manufacturing sector, you're doing pretty good with Canada.
What about the ag sector? Can you break that one out?
The ag sector last year between our countries was roughly balanced. It was $47.2 billion in total trade between the countries. You exported to us $24.7 billion, and you imported from us $22.5 billion. So again, enormous, roughly in balance with you guys enjoying a small surplus.
And specifically there in Canada, from Iowa, corn, beans, is that what gets to Canada from our soils?
No, corn is actually more with your Mexican partners. What's interesting about when you do free trade agreements, Ben, is most people think of trade between countries as trading different goods. I sell you furniture and you sell me widgets. And that's sort of how we tend to conceptualize trade. But actually trade patterns, particularly when you do a free trade agreement, what you see is an incredible development of trade within a sector and oftentimes within companies. So if you look at the agricultural trade between Canada and Iowa, I don't think I would be surprising any of your listeners if I said pork.
Absolutely. You would not, and, you would not surprise us, right?
No. So if you look at Iowa's top five agricultural exports to Canada, what would jump out at you there is first of all, your largest export in all sectors to Canada is agricultural equipment and machinery. Those are all those John Deere tractors going up to Canada. We import most of our farm equipment and machinery from the United States. So John Deere is a great Iowa company that does very well on that trade. So that's your largest export to Canada from Iowa is ag equipment and machinery. But also in those top five is you send us a heck of a lot of animal feed, and you send us a heck of a lot of fresh and frozen pork. And in the middle of that chain, one of our largest exports to you are live animals. So when you put those facts together, what we've accomplished in the pork sector under NAFTA is an incredibly integrated supply chain. You send us the farm equipment, you send us the animal feed. We're pretty good at birthing and raising piglets. You are very good at processing fully grown hogs into products, and then some of that meat comes back to Canada. So it's an incredibly well-developed integrated supply chain between our countries.
Paul Connors is with me, Canada's Consul General for Iowa, four other states, talking a little bit about trade at this point. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk a little bit, well, to finish up here with NAFTA, it sounds like you are optimistic, as you see it, that a renegotiation will result in a win-win-win under NAFTA, and that really this idea that was thrown out there many times on the campaign trail by then-candidate Trump that NAFTA is going to go away, that's not going to happen.
I think that's fair, Ben. I would make one other point, and not to put too big a damper on it, but I do think there is a bit of a cloud on the horizon, and we've been very clear that there's a couple of the proposals that the U.S. negotiators put on the table that, as proposed, cause us some concern, and to us, they reflect backing away from our stated goal of taking NAFTA and making it new and improved and actually take a step back. And maybe if I can just give you a
sure.
couple of that. The current NAFTA, of course, has a dispute settlement mechanism that's binding on the parties whenever we get to an impasse, be it companies or the governments. And so we have a mechanism that's binding on the parties to settle those disputes. One of the U.S. proposals is to make that to give the parties the ability to opt into that binding mechanism or not. We believe it's always been Canada. For those that recall the negotiation of the original Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, which predates NAFTA, a bottom line for Canada has always been to have a binding mechanism to settle disputes fairly. When they come, they don't come up that often, but there have been a few.
So that just avoids a situation when you don't like the outcome of a decision that you just say, no, I'm not going to abide by it.
Yeah, so to put it simply, to give the parties the right to opt out is problematic for us in the negotiations. I'm not one of the negotiators. They'll keep working on that. So that's one that Canada has signaled mm-hmm. is a challenge for us in the negotiation. And maybe another example, you played that clip, the clip from the president where he said he would take recourse to the exit mechanism in the existing NAFTA. He's absolutely right. All treaties, including NAFTA, have an exit provision, but barring any company accessing or those provisions, the treaty isn't enforced and is presumed to be enforced going forward. So one of the American proposals in one of the rounds was to change that to every 5 years, all three countries have to proactively renew NAFTA, and failing all three countries renewing it in every 5 years, the treaty would not be renewed. So we kind of scratch our head on that one on the Canadian side and say, well, we're trying to make this new and improved. There is an existing exit mechanism if someone's unhappy and wants to get out. But barring that, we're giving a great signal to our companies and investors that come take advantage of this economic zone that we've created through the three countries. And businesses take investment decisions on longer cycles than 5 years. So we think a five-year renewal clause that's being proposed undercuts what we're trying to do. So to go back to the first point you made, though, I think if we all stick to what we said we would do when the three countries agreed to launch the renegotiation, which is, you know, emphasize the positive and come out with new and improved, we can get to a new and improved NAFTA.
Okay. We have a few more minutes with Paul Connors, Canada's Consul General for Iowa and four other states. Before we go, I wanted to ask you, you know, how many Canadians are in Iowa at any given time or visit Iowa? Do you have any data on that? You said you assist Canadians in the five states, including Iowa.
I can tell you our tourist numbers. So a Canadian spent $11 million in Iowa last year, and that reflected some 76,000 Canadian visitors to Iowa. So that was over the whole year. And if you'll permit me to make a little Canadian joke, and the way you can tell those Canadians when they're walking around Council Bluff or Cedar Rapids or Des Moines is just catch them saying thank you to the ATM when it gives them money.
That's a good one. With a nice Canadian accent, a thank you.
For sure, eh?
I wonder how the challenge, part of your job is to assist and protect the citizens of Canada who are in the United States, in these five states. How has that challenge changed during the Trump presidency, given the heightened concerns about immigration in this country, the less welcoming stance the U.S. has taken toward undocumented immigrants, those with temporary refugee status? Has that changed your oversight, your assistance to Canada's citizens in this country?
No, not at all, Ben. I mean, the United States is a modern, developed, rich country that's very welcoming and opening on legal migration. So our consular section down here, as I said at the beginning, it's mainly Canadians that are in the States and find they've lost their passport or had their purse stolen and they don't have their papers anymore. That's the vast majority of we work on in terms of consular cases helping Canadians in the United States. And then on immigration, that's something that both countries pursue to their benefits. And what I would say there is both of our countries have a long tradition of being welcome and opening on legal immigration, and Canada continues with that policy in Canada.
Has there been any change in sort of net exchange of Canadians coming south or Americans going north that you can see or that you concern yourself with?
Well, here's what I like about how close Canadians and Americans are to each other. I always like to say that there's no closer bilateral relationship in the world between any two Canadians in any two countries than Canada and the United States. And what I would point out there is I always find it interesting whenever we have a national election in Canada, and if the party on the right wins, then supporters on the left say, I'm moving to the United States, and vice versa. And whenever you have a national election in the United States, you know, if the Republican wins, you have some Democrats saying, I'm moving to Canada. Or if the Democrat wins, they say, oh, some Republicans say, I'm moving to Canada. We don't say that about any other country. So, and of course, Canadians and Americans can move to each other's countries, but they have to follow normal.
Does that in fact happen? Do you think, do you hear from people that they in fact do make that move based on any political?
I've heard people say it. I've never had anyone aware of them doing it. But I think the fact that people say it on both sides of the border speaks to how closely we hold each other.
All right. We have to go. Paul Connors, Canada's Consul General for Iowa. We appreciate the conversation, sir.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay. When we come back after a short break, I discuss the Oscar-nominated film Darkest Hour with retired Iowa judge Douglas Russell. He's the author of two books about Winston Churchill. He knows a lot about this figure, Winston Churchill, an iconic figure of the 20th century. We'll talk about it with Douglas Russell when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
There's nothing patriotic in fighting to the end. Now is the time to negotiate.
When will the lesson be learned? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth.
That's a bit of the trailer from Darkest Hour, nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Actor. There you heard Gary Oldman bringing Winston Churchill to life in this new film, which is receiving a lot of attention, a lot of acclaim. Joining me now to talk about the new film and Churchill's legacy is a senior Iowa judge, Douglas Russell. He's been on our program before, but it's been quite a number of years. Judge Russell, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Ben.
You were the author of two books about Winston Churchill. It's been a lifelong passion. Would that be a good way to describe it?
I think so. Since I first read his autobiography in high school, I've read a lot about Churchill.
Mm-hmm. One of your books, the most recent, Winston Churchill's Soldier, The Military Life of a Gentleman at War, was published in 2005. I unfortunately couldn't make it out to see this film. I tried, but would have to drive quite a ways to see it. As it turns out, there are a lot of other competing films out there. You have seen this film. It's set during the early days of World War II. The fate of Western Europe hangs on this newly appointed British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. The point here, do you negotiate with Adolf Hitler? I wonder if you can kind of share your thoughts, because I think in historical perspective, that those who didn't live through this time, that winning World War II was not a foregone conclusion, and that 39 and 1940 were very precarious years, and Winston Churchill came onto the scene, and it wasn't at all clear that the Allies were going to be victorious.
Well, that's true, and I'm reminded of American historian David McCulloch's statement that one of the hardest things to convey in the teaching and writing of history is that nothing ever had to turn out the way that it did. Things were never on a track then any more than they are now. And this was a very crucial period in British and world history, 1940, the period that's depicted in the film. Just to set the background a little bit, on May 10th, 1940, the day that Churchill was appointed prime minister, Germany invaded France. Germany already controlled large parts of the European continent. The only comparable period of difficulty I can think of in history was when Abraham Lincoln took office. The Confederate States had seceded between his election and his inauguration, and the Civil War began within weeks of his inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
But for Churchill, the British forces had in effect been defeated in France. France was on the verge of surrender. The Dunkirk evacuation to save the British army from annihilation was forming. And this was really decision time for the British government. And the decision was whether to negotiate with Hitler or to continue fighting, knowing full well that you might lose.
Mm-hmm. And Winston Churchill, with his position, did that form right away not to negotiate? Did that take some time? Did he arrive at that position immediately in the face of all these critics who said you must negotiate with Hitler?
Well, Churchill had been one of the leading members of the parliamentary opposition warning of the Nazi menace throughout the 1930s. He was a student of history. He'd been in the government for decades, and he was believed strongly that the battle between Hitler and Britain was a battle between barbarism and civilization, and that the future of Western civilization and its values were at stake. I think his instinct was to fight on, fight to the death. But he felt it was his duty to consider the alternatives. And you must remember the people that were urging negotiations had in mind the rather fresh memory of the First World War, which was only 22 years in the past, and was fought at great cost to the European countries, and particularly Britain.
Mm-hmm. And,
So I think the final outcome was Churchill's starting point and his ending point.
Mm-hmm.
But he did listen to the opposition, and there was a lot of politics to rally the larger cabinet to his side.
Mm-hmm. And we mustn't forget a lot of the writing, your research on Winston Churchill, and you know what the life he led before this. Included a number of wars, even in the First World War. So that shaped him as well, being well, as you say in the subtitle, the military life of a gentleman at war. War was something he knew well up to at this point in his life.
That's right. He went to the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. He was 5 years a British cavalry officer, fought in combat on three continents. And then in an interlude in his parliamentary career, at age 40, he served for 6 months as a battalion infantry commander in World War I. So he was very familiar with the costs of war.
Mm-hmm. We know Winston Churchill as the epitome of confidence, of perseverance. This is what he's come down in history to be. I wanted to play something that reveals perhaps, we'll just say, his inner battles, a little clip from the movie From Darkest Hour, with Gary Oldman portraying Winston Churchill. Here, Winston Churchill is dealing with his inner battles. In this scene, we see anything but a confident Winston Churchill talking with his wife.
My darling, you have the full weight of the world on your shoulders.
I know.
But these inner battles have actually trained you for this very moment. You are strong because you are imperfect. You are wise because you have doubts. Now, shall I let him in?
Who?
The king.
Which king? Our king?
Well, if it isn't him, it's a marvellous impersonation.
Okay, what a scene there. Strong, you are strong because you are imperfect, his wife says. You are wise because you have doubts. Through your historical lens of reviewing Winston Churchill's life, what can you tell us about his inner battles when we only have this public face that we look back on with confidence?
Well, he had great confidence in his own star, as he put it, from childhood onward. But he was faced with doubts about whether he would measure up to his own expectations. Before he joined his regiment in India as a young man, he went as an observer to the war between the Cubans and the Spaniards in 1895 just to test himself and see whether he could stand up under fire. Mm-hmm. It was a private test trip that he said.
And did he?
He did. He did very well. He was under fire right around his 21st birthday and was glad that he survived the ordeal. And he said in later years that he never really had any physical fear. And other people noticed that about him, too. He would stand up amidst gunfire in combat in the Sudan or in South Africa. I think the doubts that he had were not so much about his own abilities, but as he said at the time, about whether it was too late to meet the Nazi menace and actually succeed in the war.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing about the clip is that his wife is talking with him, a very close confidant there. What can you say about that relationship?
That was a strong marriage. And Clementine, although she was not a public figure, was very influential in Churchill's life. And she often would call him to task. She was one of the few people who could criticize him or give him directions and get away with it.
And bolster him as
And bolster him, yeah. His daughter, Churchill's daughter, Lady Soames, said her career, Clementine Churchill's career, was him.
Senior Iowa Judge Douglas Russell, he's based at the Johnson County Courthouse. I mistakenly called him a retired Iowa judge. I'd seen an article about that from several years ago, but you're working as a senior judge in Iowa. Glad to have you talking about Winston Churchill as the author of two books about Winston Churchill. The last being Winston Churchill's Soldier, The Military Life of a Gentleman at War, published in 2005. Well, let's have your sort of impressions of how you think that film compares with other films that feature Winston Churchill portrayed. Here, Gary Oldman, he's up for an Oscar as Best Actor here.
Well, the buzz in the Churchill community is that Oldman is one of the best at performing Churchill, comparable to Robert Hardy, who did a miniseries for television in Great Britain called The Wilderness Years a few years ago. Oldman is very good, and many of the words that he speaks are from the historical record. Some of them are out of context, but they are many of them are very accurate. And I think the film generally is very good, very historically accurate. The only glaring dramatic license is a scene in the London Underground when Churchill goes to Parliament to make his speech that we shall fight on. He's portrayed as speaking to the common people in a subway car and getting their views about whether they should fight on. Of course, this never happened.
And is it conceivable that Winston Churchill would have done that even?
No, not at all. Churchill is the kind of person who wouldn't ask the public what to do. He would tell them what they should do.
So when we talk about Gary Oldman or any other actor capturing the essence of Winston Churchill, what does that mean to capture that essence? Well, how would you sum up that character if you were going to give advice to an actor to play Winston Churchill?
Well, I think the first trait is the trait of eloquence. He's a brilliant speaker and a brilliant writer. People don't realize that he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1953 for his writings. But he was eloquent in a good parliamentary speaker and a very compelling and convincing speaker. I also think they need to capture his humanity, the way he dealt with the people around him. And importantly, and I think Oldman did this very well, is you have to capture that twinkle in the eye, the humor that Churchill had. He was extremely funny.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned his humor because I have a clip from the new film, Darkest Hour, that deals with his humor. We'll hear a little bit here. It's let me explain it a little bit before we hear this segment. You will recognize it having just seen the film. This is where an assistant to Winston Churchill needs to tell the prime minister that the way in which he gestured the V for victory sign with his two fingers showing his hand from the back instead of from the palm side has an unintended meaning for some in Britain. So let's listen to this.
Look, I'm not sure if you know this, but the way you're doing your V for victory sign, well, in the poorer quarters, that gesture means something else.
What does it mean?
Well, I wouldn't like to say, sir.
I was captured by the Boer. I spent time in a South African prison.
Up your bum. Sir.
Up your bum.
The way you're doing it, sir. Yes, sir. But if you turn it around, that's fine. I wouldn't like millions of people to take it the wrong way.
Oh, indeed. Load up your bum!
It's hard not to laugh just hearing that scene from Darkest Hour. So is this historically accurate? You talked about the twinkle in the eye. There, it's not Winston Churchill's joke, but the fact that that this has played out, he finds uproariously funny.
Well, I haven't read that story before, but it's one of those stories about Churchill that if it's not true, it should be because it's so characteristic of him.
And the characteristic is that he's not conventional. He's not going to be uptight about the fact that his V for Victory sign is a different sign.
That's right. And when he introduced himself to his battalion in the First World War, he said to the officers, "War is to be fought with a smile. If you can't smile, at least grin. If you can't grin, get out of the way."
Let's talk a little bit about, well, what if there, we talked about the precarious position that the world was in and when he became prime minister in 1940, and that's covered in this film. With France being pretty much conquered by the Nazi Reich at that time. You must have thought about the question, what would we be today without Winston Churchill?
Well, I think if Churchill had not been in office, there would have been a settlement. I think Germany would have been left in control of the European continent. Having done so, Britain would have become a secondary power. And whatever treaty had been made, I don't believe Churchill would have honored it. I think he would have intended to disarm Great Britain and make them, in effect, a vassal state. Mm-hmm. It's unknowable, of course, what would have happened with the Soviet Union. But in any event, I think Britain would have fallen from the ranks of great powers. And I think that the values of Western democratic civilization would have been at risk by the barbarism of the Nazi regime.
And Winston Churchill had a lot to do with convincing Roosevelt to get into the war. And so it would have been a question whether the Germans, the Nazis, would have had to fight a war on two fronts.
Well, that is an open question. Churchill worked very hard to bring the Americans into the war because he knew they were needed. And you have to remember that Britain and its Commonwealth allies fought Germany alone for a year before the Soviet Union came into the conflict, and a year and a half before the Americans did. So it was very precarious.
Okay. A listener listening to our conversation right now has a different attitude toward Winston Churchill. Well, I would like to react to that, Judge Douglas Russell. When you talk about, this is from Twitter, when you talk about Winston Churchill, can you please talk about how he was a bloodthirsty white supremacist who defended British imperialism to his dying day?
I think what you need to do is, I disagree, of course, with the caller. I think you need to read more deeply into the history of Winston Churchill and understand the contexts. I disagree that he was bloodthirsty. I do agree he was a defender of the British Empire. But whether that was an evil thing or not is something that merits further study.
Right. And it's always question when you look at historical figures with the norms, societal norms of that day, to bring them into the present with our present norms, is that a fair thing to do, or how do you evaluate that transfer of someone, you know, from how many years ago?
Well, people often ask the question, what would Churchill do?
Right.
And I think the proper question is, what should we do with Churchill's example in mind? And I think the answer to that question, taken from his own words, is to be truthful in public life, to be clear in your thinking and speaking and writing, and to be of good courage in the face of adversity.
Mm-hmm. Having studied Churchill for so long, written about him in two books, do you notice any common misperceptions we have about Winston Churchill that you run across? Besides, I think that the simplification of his character is perhaps one that springs to mind for me. He's almost a caricature, isn't he?
Well, he's considered by some that way. He said himself, nothing surpasses 1940. That for him was the pinnacle. But he had a long career. He was in Parliament from 1900 until 1965. He held every cabinet position except the premiership and the Secretary of Foreign Affairs before he became prime minister. He'd been in politics for 40 years before he became prime minister at the age of 65. And it was a very winding path to number 10 Downing Street.
Mm-hmm.
So he had failures along the way and some successes along the way. But he was viewed in his own circles as erratic and impulsive, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that kind of stubbornness and almost impetuosity and willingness to try new things to defeat the Germans was what was needed at that time.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on how he might fit into today's political climate?
Well, I think he would stick to his principles, as I say, of truthfulness, eloquence, and courage.
Hmm.
I don't know what his opinions about current issues would be. No one does.
Yeah, that would be a hard one to answer. Tell us, Judge Russell, about your interest in why this man became such a consuming, in a good way, part of your life to study him, to write books about Winston Churchill. What's first sparked that interest?
Well, I first read his autobiography, as I said. The book is called My Early Life. And he struck me as sort of a polymath, a serious person with a great sense of humor. People should read, if they read one book about Churchill, they should read My Early Life and the fun he makes of mathematics in school. That alone is worth reading. But I thought of Churchill the way I thought about Theodore Roosevelt or Thomas Jefferson, first reading about them. They were so interesting. They're so complicated and in a lot of ways so admirable, even though they all had their faults. And studying history and politics since college, I bumped up against Churchill a good deal. I've been a member of the International Churchill Society for over 30 years.
They must be liking this film.
I think generally it's being very well received, except for the London Underground scene.
And they're not liking what about it?
Well, it just doesn't ring true because Churchill did not use
the underground scene.
Yeah, the underground sequence and not the cabinet war rooms, which were the underground cabinet meeting rooms. But the subway scene just wasn't so.
Mm-hmm.
And it portrayed Churchill as perhaps less confident than he was. You know, he wouldn't ask the man on the street whether we should fight the Germans. He would be thinking about how to convince the rest of the government to do so.
Judge Russell, how do you feed your Winston Churchill passion these days?
Mostly by reading. There are so many books about Churchill coming out all the time. It's like putting Lady Di on the cover of a magazine. You put Churchill on a book and it's going to sell some copies.
And after all this research that you've done, are you still learning new things about this man, Winston Churchill?
Yes, I am. And I'm very pleased to be among the Academy of Churchill Historians. We exchange information, send inquiries to one another, and enjoying being footnoted by other historians.
Very quickly before we go, are there any great open questions, hotly debated questions among Churchill researchers like yourself?
Well, one of the current debates concerns recent books about the Dardanelles campaign, which is a World War I campaign that resulted in not only great losses to the British Army, but Churchill being fired from the cabinet and ending up in the trenches.
Okay. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Fascinating to talk with you again after all these years. The last time we spoke on the radio, Judge Russell, was more than 10 years ago, I believe.
I believe it was. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you so much for coming into the studio. Senior Iowa Judge Douglas Russell, author of a couple of books about Winston Churchill, including Winston Churchill's Soldier, The Military Life of a Gentleman at War. Tomorrow, it's our News Buzz edition of River to River. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Help today from Lulu Dewey. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.